SAFM Literature with Karabo Hulet.
In reports before daybreak, the epic tale sweeps through a country in its darkest decade to where a new dawn is breaking as three young people each emerge from their own cocoon, black domestic servitude, guilt-ridden white privilege, nationalistic zeal. Their fates are thrown together in the convulsions of the bigger battle for change. The struggle of the 1980s becomes their story, and with it, their first experiences of danger, betrayal, and love. It's written by theater critic, restaurant reviewer, and travel writer. His first novel, Primary Colored, was published in 2007. From Cape Town, let's welcome Brent Meersman. Brent, welcome to SAFM Literature.
Yes, good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. Now, why did you choose the 60s as a starting, well, a prologue point for your novel?
Yes, what I wanted to do really was give us, paint a portrait of the country and really trace the whole period of the Republic period. And of course, we're coming up for the 50th anniversary. I don't think anybody's going to be celebrating. But since 1961, now to 2011, it's 50 years on. So that gives the real background, the setting, as it were, the ethos from which these characters have then emerged. And then I take the action. Really, the main action is from 1978 to 1990.
Now, you bring three vast stories together. How do you achieve that without losing a sense of continuity throughout the plot?
Well, I think that, what happens is that the stories really parallel each other. So I think that what happened under apartheid was that, the differences between people were exaggerated. And in fact, that we all share the same humanity. So what I have with the characters is that they have to go through the same rites of passages. They have to experience the world. They all got to go through their relationship with their parents, their relationship with God, with authority, going into exile, going to school, going to university. So we all experience these things. But obviously, due to political and social forces that were at work at that time, they experienced very differently. So if you're reading through the narrative, you're really reading these parallel stories, and each story reflects the other person's life in some way. And in that way, I make them collide, of course, towards the end of the book. They all get connected.
Now, Francois' family history is a particularly interesting one. You trace his back to the pogroms and how his family ends up in South Africa. Now, what element does this bring to the story, the fact that he can trace his ancestry that far back?
Well, I think that, one has to, well, in his particular case, what one has is one has got, there have been other struggles. There's struggles before the South African struggle. There are people who have lived through, depressingly, humanity just seems to repeat the same mistakes again and again. It learns the lessons, but then it seems to do it all over again. And I think that, you've got something like that, you've got this background, this other awareness. Now, Francois, he lands up in Angola. He lands up with an invading force from the South African Defence Force. But his father had lived under Nazi oppression in Belgium. So he's alert to this. His brother's more alert to it than he is. But that's really where I weave that in. And then, of course, we have the struggle of people in South Africa as well, amongst the Xhosa and the frontier wars. So those narratives also constantly inform the lives of the black characters as well.
And the two brothers are also quite interesting. Although they are raised in the same family, their difference is quite striking in that Francois' brother is a lot gentler. He's portrayed as better looking, intellectually smarter even, does better at school. Yet Francois is the man, as it were, if you were to use macho language. But you also have the other thread in which you have Mfundi, who becomes the young freedom fighter, and how he discovers what he thought was his own, was his actual identity, is revealed to him in a rather shocking manner at the same time during which he has to flee from home. What do you illustrate by these two kinds of sort of sibling relationships and how they bring the political and the social and the various taboos into play?
Yes, well, I think that, you know, if you're looking at Mfundi, where he's coming from, and he becomes the Mkhonto we Zizwe fighter, and then you're looking at Francois, who sort of ends up in the SADF, I mean, the assumption is that these two characters are opposites. But what you start discovering during the course of the novel is that they actually are not opposites. Their opposites are, in fact, Francois' brother, Joe, and Mfundi's sister, Zukizwa, are actually more alike, and they're the opposite of the two fighters. So you have these two boys that are fighting there on opposite ends of the war, but they're actually very similar in many ways. And the true opposites are the artists and the people who are trying to get on with their lives and explore their talents against all odds, who really want nothing to do with the struggle, and yet are also tempted into it. So I think that's the trick, one of the tricks of the book.
Another trick of the book, of course, is talking about society and how families work together. In Zukiswa's case, of course, we discover that Zukiswa's mother is also Mfundi's mom, without giving too much away.
Yes.
But this is a kind of story that that I've been familiar with in speaking with family members, in speaking with people from a similar background as myself, in which you find that a young girl happens to fall pregnant with a child, and the child is either raised as part of the family, but the mom is looked upon as an older sister, or the child is raised by an aunt or uncle whom they believe to be the biological parents, yet they discover later on what the real story is. And why did you choose to go about having Mfundi respond to this revelation in the manner in which he did?
Yeah, all the stories are really based on people that, they're compilations of narratives and of people that I know. And so a lot of that has informed it. And the characters, you know, they develop in their own ways. They kind of develop almost organically and naturally. And sometimes they tell, they actually tell me what they're going to do. I mean, when Zukizwa decides to lose her virginity, she decided that at that point. I had nothing to do with it. But returning to your question about their identity, is that in the case of Mfundi, the real point there is that, you know, that his very identity is actually a conspiracy against the authorities, as it is put, because yes, he's raised by his aunt, in fact, but that's the only way that he was able to be given the education that he got and that particular standard of living in the township, as opposed to being relegated to the informal settlement in very strained circumstances where there was no security and they could be deported or they could be forcefully removed at any point, which is the experience that Zukizwa has. And so what I'm doing with Zukizwa again is that I'm really want to make the point there, it emerges of its own, that education is fundamental to it, and it really takes one generation. It's one generation of a solid education with her teacher, Lomini, who cares about her, that actually allows her to do the things that she does do in life. Mfundi's reaction, why he goes off to Mkhonto we Zizwe, is not just so much about his whole world is rocked by this discovery that his parents are not his actual parents, and that opens up other possibilities. But it's when he feels that he's kind of, what the runt in the litter, as it were, who's really brought terrible harm upon his family by his actions. He feels that he's responsible for what happens to his mother, his step parents,
yeah.
And he feels an enormous guilt, and then he decides to throw it all up and to get the hell out of there. And that's really what I was doing with Mfundi.
And I suppose it also shows that when one is talking, especially as a young ideological person, about going to war and going to fight for a bigger cause, that one is not ready for the kind of brutality that they have to deal with and the kind of brutality that they have to perpetuate in order to achieve the kind of justice that they want. In Francois' case, that being to protect his people. And in Mfundi's case, that being to liberate his people. And the way in which that education takes place, in terms of the kind of indoctrination that they receive, and how you draw parallels to that. What tools did you use to achieve that?
Well, you put it pretty exactly. I mean, you know, when I'm really concerned about the enormous moral and emotional toll that period took on people, because you know, if people are put into a situation where they are tested in a way that no human being should be tested, they will fail. I mean, that's, you know, I think that's, there are very, very few exceptions to that. And so really, you know, using the novel as you can get that gray area where our characters, they're full of contradictions, they're full of ironies. They're both, you know, they're conflicted internally about what they are doing. And they keep telling us, you know, they have no regrets and they have to become more and more like stone. They have to become more and more invulnerable and emotionally detached in order to do what they feel they need to do. So they get deeper and deeper, you know, sucked into this world of violence until, you know, in the last third of the book, you know, they're all the characters, in fact, reach breaking point.
Breaking point and how different characters cope with it also reveals a lot about humanity. Why was it important for you to add bits of history through the book as it took place? You have the free flow of the story and you break it up with various historical events that actually took place, and then you bring it back into the real lived experience at that time with each character. How did you achieve that?
Interesting in that this is the way, I mean, the novel is an experimental form. It always has been. It's in its DNA. And I think what they work on very, very different ways. So just to tell the listeners that, you know, each chapter is a year, and each year opens with the headlines from that period. Mm-hmm. So then what I do is I collage those headlines. There's always this tension between reporting and creating, between relating events and shaping them. So I take the headlines and then I will, you know, I'll thematically link them. So, and they're linked in very subtle ways, just often just by one word and its associations as it moves through from headline to headline and then, you know, transmutes into another idea. So you would have, you know, I'll talk about miners, gold miners plummet to their death, and then the next headline will be gold prices soar on the JSE. And then that'll take you to a new thought. But they paint the context of the time. I mean, I was really at pain. I've really written this book for South Africa. I've written this book for our country. And I wanted to do a portrait of that period. And we're blurring fiction and nonfiction more and more. I mean, I just think that's part of the 21st century. You know, and the more stories that we've become aware of. So I've introduced these eyewitness accounts, which are these little vignettes, which are in the first person, which introduce new voices, and they amplify things that might be going on in the lives of the characters. And then there are the biographies of actual people. And sometimes those are quite obvious in the way that they relate. I mean, there's the story of George Pember, the black painter, and then that relates to Joe, who wants to become a painter. Some of them are more subtle. They're talking about how there are other narratives, other options for my characters, examples of other lives that they could lead, other examples that they could follow. What a lot of readers have said to me is that by having these other biographies in between, they kind of begin to think about my fictional characters as real-life characters, that they're just getting a series of biographies, the five main, you know, main individuals that I trace, that I've invented, and in all the other individuals that I bring in. It's part of a worldwide trend, really, in historical research, is that more and more we are looking at narrative histories to tell the story of the times. I mean, I think the TRC was a very good example of that. And when you talk about character, you can bring in all the grey areas, you can bring in the contradictions and the ironies and the complexity of individual lives, which is not always told when you look at sort of a macro history, when you look at the master narrative of what happened. And so I'm questioning those master narratives, I'm presenting them, and at the same time I'm almost problematizing them with the fictional characters.
And you're also bringing home something that families and individuals go through, because when you open up platforms and you ask people to call, where were you on, you know, in 1994 on the 27th of April, or where were you when JFK was shot or John Lennon was shot? Where were you on the opening day of the FIFA World Cup? These are grand periods in our collective histories, yet they have different meanings and they play themselves out differently in terms of the memory that arises personally and within our families, and that creates a whole new kind of biography that's set in this history.
Mm. Yes, I do think that, yeah, and there's always with that, there's an irony in that, you know, one, things are experienced in ambiguous ways. It's not quite clear, you know, not very simple to say, yes, okay, so, because in that period of the 1980s, you had this tremendous hope, because everybody could see that, you know, the apartheid regime was going to collapse. At the same time, the people trapped within it was this complete nihilism, that it was like there was no hope, that this was, the world was going to end, basically. And even people that, you know, on the left, we were stuck in it with saying, you know, we're going to die for this. This is you know, this is going to be the ultimate sacrifice, is what is going to be called, you know, called for here. So, so the 1980s is, for me, a bit of a blind spot in our history. There's so much, when I wrote this book, I've read a lot of, did a lot of research, which I've always done, but you know, there's so much written about Sharpeville and about the 1976 uprising, a Rivonia trial, that whole period up until, you know, up to about 76, Serafina time, and then post 1990 about the transformation. But in fact, the 1980s has become a bit of a blind spot, a very raw period. And I felt now we had reached the point where we had sufficient time had passed for us to start examining this. And I'm seeing it all over, by the way. I'm seeing a lot of books now emerging. I'm even thinking of Winnie the Opera by Bongani and Dodana Breen, which is, you know, was on at the State. I mean, also dealing with that 1980s period where nobody comes out, you know, smelling of roses. So that, yeah, that's really what I wanted to do with this.
Which is why it was not an easy book to read, in terms of those are memories that you speak to families who were in the townships during the 80s, and people who were young during those days, where schools were being burnt down, where you were no longer sure who was the enemy and who wasn't, even though you were fighting this big demon called apartheid, because there were so many other forces at play. And it was becoming unclear as to where exactly the world stood and what questions there were about the future. And to a certain extent, you know, when you write about a domestic servitude, which is something that we have seen as recently as in the last few days in newspapers, when you look at certain struggles and strikes that have turned violent in townships, there's almost a sense of reminiscence of those days where even today it's difficult to have people to talk about the 80s. I mean, if you were to say there was one particular event in the 80s in the South African psyche, what would it be? That's a difficult question to answer, and I think your book raises that point.
Thank you. Yes, I think that it's always the muddied waters of actual conflict. I mean, even if we look now, you know, we look at Libya, we look at North Africa, and that it's not a simple story, you know, of a revolutionary overthrow, and there's just good guys and bad guys. There's all kinds of power play. And particularly, I thought important was the conflict in Crossroads. And the reason why I focused on that was because you see the same thing has been happening with the xenophobic violence. It's the people themselves tearing one another apart. It's the poor attacking the poor. And it's hugely complicated with, there are warlords, there are shack lords, there are businessmen involved, there are politics, different political factions, there are community leaders who want particular power. So the waters become very, very muddied. So it's not a simple matter of, I would say it was violence characterized by xenophobia. And that whole Crossroads section of the warfare in Reports Before Daybreak, for me, really holds the key to understanding the recent violence characterized by xenophobia. And also then looking at the other conflicts on the continent as well, when we look at our own story. those things are all related, and then of course torture. You know, I mean, one of the things which very close to my heart in the 1980s is that the injustice, and you know, and I talk about Tumol and various other people and what happened to them, that they cannot have extrajudicial justice, and then we see those lessons have not been learnt by America, they have not been learnt by the rest of the world.
And we're still waiting.
Yes. Well, this is the nature of literature, is just to keep us aware of these things, and somebody's got to, you know, somebody's got to voice those things. So on one level, it's sort of a, yes, it looks like a historical novel because of the way that I've treated it, but what I'm really concerned with is the chronicle of my generation. So in other words, it's people in their 40s and in their 50s. And I see my contemporaries popping up all over the place now, you know, arguing cases in the Constitutional Court. Some are members of Parliament. Some university friends of mine are now, you know, editorial heads of national newspapers. So it's that generation which is very much with us now, which, due to the natural progression of things, are really coming into their own in the country. And I wanted to tell that story, the story of that generation.
Thank you for that story.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is Brent Meersman, author of The Reports Before Daybreak, a really important piece of history that is steeped, I mean, a piece of fiction that is steeped in history. It was a pleasure having you on SFM.
Thank you.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.